Now, as we look at the last section in our study in Genesis, I said we would do Genesis 1 to 11. So we come into the last of our studies in this series. And what you have here is the rise of languages. I want you to notice how Moses had the answer to several questions beginning with the word why. Why is there a world? Why is this earth here? And we see that in the first chapter it is created by God and it is good, and it was good. And then we see, why is it that there is male and female? And you have in chapter 2 that God created the male and female for partnership and for loving relationship with one another, and that they might bring forth children and raise them up in the admonition of the Lord. And then you get the answer to the question, well, why is it that man is dying creature? Why does man die? Why is he frail? Why has he got diseases? Why is he so wicked and sinful, as it were? And you get the answer in chapter 3, the fall of man. And then you have the answer to the question, why is it that some are good and some are bad? Well, you get it in chapter 4, that those who trust in God and repent, like Abel, they are the good, and those who are rebellious, like Cain, they are the bad. And then you have the question, why is it that the rocks are full of fossils? Why is it that the earth is the shape it is? Why are there so many continents and so many seas? And you get the whole question of the flood. Why does man die so quickly? Why doesn't he live longer than he actually does do? And the answer again is in the flood. So you have the difference between the people in chapter 5 who lived to an average of 900 years and the people after the flood whose lives were very much shorter. Well, therefore, you get one more question, and that is, why are there languages? Why are there such a large number of languages and dialects? And you get the answer here in chapter 11. So you've got certain fundamental questions answered for you in Genesis. And I was saying that many nations and cultures have nothing at all in relation to these matters. And again, you won't find in any other culture an explanation of the rise of languages as you get here in chapter 11. Now, do you remember that after the flood, if you look back at chapter 9, in verse 7, God told Noah, as for you, be fruitful and increase in number. Multiply on the earth and increase upon it. And here in chapter 11, you have the people rebelling and refusing to spread around the earth and trying to congregate in one place. Now you notice at the beginning of chapter 11, it says the whole world had one language and a common speech. Now remember that the ark came down on the mountain range known as Ararat. And from there, people spread eastwards, it says in verse 2. Now that would include southeastward. And southeastward from Ararat brings you down to the valleys of the river Tigris and Euphrates and down to the area that we know as Babylon and the top of the Persian Gulf. Well, the whole of that area, all those people that stemmed from Noah, they had one language and a common speech. What it says in the original, they were of one lip. That means that everybody formed their words in the same way. It was the same formation of words, the same accent, the same speech. And as the men moved eastwards, and they came to this plain in Shinar and settled there, they said to each other, come, or come on now, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly. And they said in verse 4, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth. Now it's that verse that expresses their rebellion. Making a name for themselves, that's their arrogance. They wanted to be famous and they wanted to remain in that very, very fertile area, and they were refusing to scatter throughout the earth. And yet God had said to Noah that they should fill the earth. They should replenish the earth. They should go to all parts of the earth. But these people were refusing. And so their rebellion is expressed in that way. They were not living to the glory of God. They were not seeking the honor of God. They were seeking their own honor, their own fame. Make a name for ourselves, that we would have a reputation. And this is expressed in the idea of building a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens. Now, there are ruins of such towers in the Middle East, and they're called ziggurats. And there are ruins of two very, very well-known ones. One outside Babylon, and the other outside a place called Borsippa. And these have several ledges, as it were, leading up to the top. And the topmost part was the temple in which sacrifices were made to the gods. So they were idolatrous symbols. And each one of these divisions would be painted in a different color, representing the various gods of the stars, the zodiac. Well, here you have the beginnings of this rebellion. Come, they said, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens. This is a figurative way of saying that they will erect a structure that is very, very noteworthy. There will be nothing like it in the whole of the world, so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth. Now, when Moses is writing this book, he makes certain explanations. And if you've got the Authorized Version, you may have the middle of verse 3 within brackets. It says there, they used brick instead of stone. Now, when Moses was writing, people were living in the desert or in the approaches to the land of Canaan, and there were plenty of rocks and stones there. So to think of people constructing a city without stone was a very, very strange idea. And so he tells them, in this land of Shinar, they didn't use stone. There were no stones. So they made bricks out of the clay, and they fired the bricks. They used brick instead of stone, and tar, or pitch, it says in the Authorized Version, a bitumen, which caused it to cling together, instead of mortar. And they said, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly. So it wasn't sun-dried bricks, which the ordinary people used for building their huts. It was bricks that were hardened and made firm in the kiln. Let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly. And then it says in brackets, as it were, they used brick instead of stone and tar or bitumen instead of mortar. Then they said, let us make this famous city for our own honor and glory. And then we read in verse 5, but the Lord came down to see the city. Now I notice that many of our Muslim friends are very perturbed by statements like this. They think that it cheapens the idea of God, that God should come down. And they speak of their God, Allah, as being far away and distant. Well, yes, that's the very point, you see. They forget that there is such a thing as literary style. And that the writer here is wanting to express that God took note of what was happening and that God observed. And so he describes God as coming down. It doesn't mean to say that God is literally having to come down from heaven in order to look upon earth, that he can't see from the distance, that he is short-sighted, that he must come near to observe and look at the detail. That isn't the point. The point is that God does dwell with man, that God does observe all our actions, that nothing that we do is something outside God's knowledge. The Lord came down. In other words, he intervened. That's what it means. He intervened. And he was going to intervene in judgment. Now you notice that there are certain periods of judgment, that people can sin for a long, long, long time, and it would seem as if God doesn't do a thing. And then there comes time when God does intervene. You get it in the letter to the Romans in the New Testament, that God gave people up to their sin and allowed them to go their own way. And then there are other occasions when he comes in judgment. You get the similar situation in the story of the people of Israel when they're in Egypt. They've been slaves and in much trouble for the best part of 400 years. And it seems as if God is not concerned. And then suddenly God intervenes and sends the 10 plagues and brings the people out from slavery. Well, here the Lord intervenes. He came down to see the city and the tower that the men were building. And the Lord said, if as one people speaking the same language they've begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible to them. He says there's a unity among them, but it is a unity of wickedness. And what unites them is this common language. So in other words, this common language would facilitate the spread of wickedness. As man was becoming more and more corrupt again after the flood, the unanimity that existed between him and his fellow men was promoting arrogance, pride, rebellion and wickedness. And you see the sadness of it. You would think, well, surely one language would be a favorable thing. One language would promote a blessing, but it was promoting a curse. Because as people were agreed in wickedness, and as they were agreed in rebellion, and as they were in agreement in defiance of God, so wickedness was spreading rapidly. And so we find that the Lord said, if that is the case, if that is what they've begun to do, then nothing that they plan to do will be impossible to them. Wickedness will become rampant throughout the whole of mankind. So he says in verse 7, come, let us go down. And you get the plural, let us, reminding us that God is three persons in one Godhead, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And although the details of that had not yet been revealed, yet when they are revealed later on, as the Bible is written, then you can see that the teaching about the Trinity is really in seed form here in this early part of Genesis. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other. Now notice, it does not say how God did it. And it does not say over what length of time he did it. Was it instantaneous? Or was it over a period of weeks, months, or even years? Well, we are not told. How did he do it? Well, he doesn't say that either. Was it that people began to adopt a different accent so that you can find in this country, for example, the Cockney might not understand the Yorkshireman and the Yorkshireman might not understand the Somersetman, etc.? Or was it that totally different language groups arose instantaneously, miraculously? We are not told. But what we are told is that God did set in motion a process, whether long or short, which resulted in divergent languages. It would appear from verse 8 as if it happened quickly. And the concept that we have of languages developing over a slow and long, long period of time, that's an evolutionary philosophy, isn't it? But here we are told in verse 8, so the Lord scattered them from there over all the earth, and they stopped building the city. And it's related to this confusing their language in verse 7. So the tower was never completed, and the city was not completed. And verse 9 tells you that is why the city was called Babel or Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole world. One translator has suggested that you translate it like this. That is why it was called Babel, because there the Lord made the Babel of languages. In other words, you had a babel of languages. You had a bedlam of languages, you see, produced. From there, therefore, the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. So the separation seems to have taken place because people were not able to understand one another. It doesn't suggest there that they went far away from one another and then the languages deviated. It would seem as if something happened, an act of judgment, which made people incapable of understanding one another. Not every individual, of course. There were groups who could understand one another and groups that couldn't understand one another. And so you had these groups separating in this manner. So it was an act of judgment. But it was also an act of mercy. Have you contemplated this? It is far more difficult for one person or one government to rule the whole world and to tyrannize the whole world because there are so many languages. If there was only one language in this world, it would be far easier for a person of the caliber of Hitler to be able to set up a tyrannical government and a central government and to rule that world and to be a dictator of the world. But the proliferation of languages does make it downright awkward. So it isn't only that it's awkward for missionaries to learn various languages to present the gospel, it also frustrates the devil's work. And so what is the judgment of God is also the mercy of God. And you can see both the anger and the mercy of God in this Tower of Babel. And then, of course, you can see something of God's amazing wonder that this act of judgment can also turn into a blessing in another form. You get literature produced in different languages, and if anybody's got a gift of languages, then they can have a certain amount of relaxation and enjoyment in reading literature in a variety of language groups. It has also meant, of course, that people who have been faced with these varieties of languages and have been given the gift of linguistic ability, they've struggled to translate the scriptures into various languages. And again, it seems that by the translation of the scriptures of the Bible into various languages, there is a reversal of the curse of the Tower of Babel. And in the book of Acts, when you get the account on Day of Pentecost, when everybody praised God in their own languages and everybody understood them in their own languages. And it would seem to suggest again that the time is coming in heaven when we shall all understand what is being said. We will understand one another, we will understand what the Lord is saying. I don't know whether there's be one language in heaven or multitudinous languages. I'm not really concerned about it. One thing I do know, we shall understand what the Lord is saying and we shall understand one another. In other words, there'll be no need for this hindrance. This hindrance here is to hinder the spread of evil. But in heaven there will be no evil. So consequently, you would imagine that the language of heaven would be a joy to everyone and understood by everyone. Well, that is the basic indication there regarding the rise of languages. It is a judgment, but it is also a mercy. And it's only our God that could do both through the same event, isn't it? Do both through the same event. Now, the next part of the chapter carries on with the genealogy. And I want to, again, put up one of the charts I gave you, and this time I've extended it a little. Do you remember when we were looking at the 10th chapter, we saw the... Oh, have I got this the right way? Now, where's the switch? Down here, is it? Yeah, do you remember? Oh. Now, what's happened? Oh, that's it. Remember when we were looking at the beginning, we saw that what I've done now, if you look at the second column in green, that's the year of birth of each of these people, and this one with the numbers in green is the year of death. So you can see that Adam lived 930 years, right? Seth lives up to the year 1042. The total age is 912. You see 930, 912, 905, 910, etc. You can see the average is round about the 900 mark. Now, see, it's not quite focused here, is it? On this side. That's better. We looked last time down to the point of the flood here. And I seem to have come without that little rod again, isn't it? That's useful. Right over, thank you. Yes, there we are. The year of the flood, 1656. Noah, living 450 years after the birth of his son, living 950 years altogether, and the year of his death, 2006, after creation. Now, I think I'd be happier if I can get that little, that little rod from that little room, you know. I don't think we need the tape recorder now, because it would be meaningless.